From New Mexico to Tennessee, Nebraska to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Congress is once again considering a carbon tax. This time, Republicans are behind the effort. Greg Wrightstone, author of Inconvenient Facts, is here with details. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, signed into law last December, has supercharged the U.S. economy. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on Tax Cuts 2.0. Housing costs in California have priced many out of the market. Now one U.S. senator wants federal taxpayers to subsidize the cost. Eric Boehm talks with Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine. And intolerance is on full display at the University of Virginia, where faculty opposition is building against the hiring of a former Trump official. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Carbon taxes are normally advocated by left-wing environmental activists, but the latest push in Congress comes not from the left, but rather from establishment Republicans. Greg Wrightstone is author of the book Inconvenient Facts, The Science Al Gore Doesn't Want You to Know. He is here to talk about a carbon tax and where it stands in Congress. Greg, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Greg, when we talk about a carbon tax, what does that mean? Most Americans, I suspect, are not familiar with that term.
Yeah, it's a tax on carbon dioxide. It's measured in metric tons. In this case, there was a carbon tax proposal that was recently introduced into the U.S. House by Republican Representative Carlos Curbelo, who's the co-chair of the Climate Solutions Caucus. And in this particular bill, they're proposing a $23 per ton CO2 tax that will be assessed at the emission source. In other words, when it comes out of the coal mine, wherever that first payment is made, that's where the carbon tax, or from the gas processing plant for natural gas. And it's not clear how all this will work, but what it will do is significantly increase energy costs for everybody. And when you increase energy costs, that's just going to drive up costs for everything using energy. It's going to increase costs just about everything in the country. This particular bill is proposed to replace the federal gasoline tax and replace it with this. And then 70% of the proceeds from this proposed gas tax or carbon tax will go to the Highway Trust Fund, and then it's split up amongst states in terms of providing winterizing, and then 5% of actually will go to the lowest income people among us. So one way to look at this is that it's a massive redistribution of the wealth, but what it will do is cost everybody more for just about everything.
So the tax would be levied at the production source, not at the point where it's actually used?
Yes, it's at the coal mine, the refinery, or the gas processing site. So of course the nuclear, wind, and solar all would be exempt because they're carbon-free sources of energy, although they're really not, because it takes carbon to create each one of these. When we talk about carbon, we really mean carbon dioxide or CO2.
So is this part of the extreme left, environmental left agenda to try to drive carbon-based fuels out of existence?
Oh, boy. It's actually, a lot of this is being driven by, believe it or not, GOP, the GOP, the return of the Bush era administration, and people like George Bush and James Baker, Trent Lott. They've all got big groups promoting a carbon tax, and it's crazy. They're teaming up with people like John Breaux from the left and Obama era retreads like Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, a huge push right now to promote this, but it really is troubling with seeing Republicans get behind it. And in fact, there was a bill that was just, or a referendum that was just introduced last Friday by Steve Scalise and a congressman from West Virginia condemning a carbon tax. And previously, the same bill had been introduced in 2013 and 2016. Basically, the same bill was proposed last week. Previously, all 100% of all Republicans voted in favor of condemning a carbon tax. This time we had 7 Republicans in the U.S. House that did not vote in favor of condemning it. It's a shame that we see these people. And what's really, really almost horrifying to find out, people like James Baker and the rest are touting a carbon tax as a free market conservative idea to solve climate change. Well, actually, what it is a solution in search of a problem. Because, as you know, and we've talked before, my opinion of this whole climate change fiasco is that while it is happening, we're seeing mostly beneficial aspects of the results of rising temperature and increasing CO2. But really, it's crazy to have these old New World Order globalists like this sign on to this carbon tax that will cost everybody in America and really impede our economy.
So we have Republicans buying into this big government agenda. At this point, is there any indication from the president or from the Trump administration as to where they stand on this issue?
So I've not seen anything from the Trump administration. I can't imagine that they would be favorable to it at all. All but 2 Democrats in the U.S. Congress voted against condemning the carbon tax. And interestingly, one of those was from Pennsylvania. That was Connor Lamb, who's going to have a tough, tough race against Keith Rothfuss, and probably one of the most contentious races in the United States out here in the Pittsburgh area. The only race in America that pits 2 sitting congressmen against each other.
As we look at this whole issue then, Greg, in terms of a carbon tax or efforts to try to extract more money from the private sector into the government from energy, what is the overarching impact of that going to be on the economy? As you mentioned, it's going to make a lot of products much more expensive. We see the economy finally starting to take off. Is this going to be an anchor on the economy then?
An anchor and a lead weight belt while you're holding a cement block. Yeah, it's going to be a huge detrimental impact on the nation's economy. And it's not clear how all this would work, because you'd be bringing in goods from across, from other countries that may not have anything like this. So you would have to impose significant tariffs on them to make up for that. It's really not clear how all that's going to work out. But yeah, it would be economically destructive and a huge drag on our economy.
We have again been talking with Greg Wrightstone. As I mentioned, he is author of the book Inconvenient Facts. Greg, tell us just a little bit about the book, where folks can get it as well.
Yeah, the book itself is written for non-scientists, although it's not dumbed down. There are 14 pages of references, but it's written for non-scientists. And the overarching theme of the book is that rising temperatures and increasing CO2 are benefiting the Earth and humanity, which is exactly opposite of what your listeners have heard. You can buy the book and go to my website, inconvenientfacts.xyz. You can buy the book there, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. It's also in brick-and-mortar stores across the United States.
Greg Wrightstone, author of Inconvenient Facts. Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Lemon.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Some interesting new legislation pending in Congress that could affect you. Andy, good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lemon.
We had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act last December. President Trump signed it. It's had a dramatic positive effect on the economy. Andy, I understand there could be more coming down the road.
Yeah, there's a lot of unfinished business from the first tax cut bill that Republicans rightfully want to fix or to complete because of the dumb rules, procedural rules in Congress. They were unable to make the individual tax cuts that they passed last year to make them permanent. Instead, they're only good for 10 years. There's also some other tax cuts in that original bill that were also temporary. So this Tax Cuts 2.0 bill would try to make all of that permanent. So it's a very good thing to do. It will give certainty to a lot of American families and businesses, and it will bring certainty to the market as well, which will allow the economy to keep growing.
In addition, Andy, to making permanent that which is currently temporary, is there any expansion of the tax credits planned or tax cuts planned?
Well, there is some talk about lowering the corporate tax rate even further, because as you recall, the goal was to get it Well, actually, the real goal was to get it down to 15%, but they were unable to do that. So then they said, okay, let's do 20%. And then after some negotiating, it went up to 21. So there is a hope that maybe we can lower it down to 15. And if that's too ambitious, maybe just somewhere in between 15 and 21. The good thing about this, about all of this, is that it's going to be voted on in September in the House. There are going to be separate bills. So the Republicans are going to force the Democrats to take a very costly vote, politically costly vote, on extending the individual tax cuts. Because as you recall, all of the Democrats opposed the original bill. So now that Republicans are coming back to clean things up and to make permanent the individual tax cuts for working families, Democrats are going to have a tough vote to make. So that's going to be very interesting to watch. Right now, nobody is predicting that this bill or these bills are going to pass into law because of the stubbornness on the part of Democrats. So this will be a very publicly and politically charged vote coming our way in September.
The fact that the tax cuts that were enacted last December, Andy, and they've now started to perk through the economy is picking up. It's clear that this has been an economic bonanza. Does that put additional pressure on Democrats? And I'm thinking particularly in the U.S. Senate, where you have a half a dozen, maybe eight or nine states where you have Democrat senators up for reelection in states that Trump carried. Does not all this put a lot of pressure on them to maybe go along with this?
So that's exactly right. We've seen just a couple of economic figures get released recently. One was GDP in the second quarter was an astounding 4.1%. That is absolutely amazing. Since 2000, there have been 70 GDP quarterly numbers reported. And of those 70 reports, only 10 have been 4% or higher. So we've been dealing with economic stagnation for a long time. And it sounds like not only are we recovering, but we're recovering very, very well. And that's in large part to the tax cuts. There was also a report that came out that said wages are growing by 2.8%, which is huge because Democrats love to talk about how the economy's not doing well because wages aren't growing. Well, guess what? Wages are now growing. So this is going to be a tough vote for Senate Democrats. And let me add, whether it passes or not, the president could also use his pen to sign an executive order indexing capital gains to inflation. And I think we've talked about this before, so I won't go into too much depth. But if he does that, he will instantly create billions and billions and billions of new wealth so that everybody with a 401k, an IRA, a brokerage account, a 529 savings account for their kids' education, all of a sudden, those accounts are going to be worth a lot more. So the Democrats are going to have a lot to explain if they keep fighting Trump on these tax cuts.
We have an economy that is improving dramatically, but the countervailing pressure when it comes to the November election is that the party of the president usually loses seats in the first midterm election. So we have that as sort of a downdraft, not to mention the various controversies that seem to always swirl around President Trump. We have a special congressional election coming up in just a couple of days, Andy, in Ohio. Could this be a bellwether, or is it still too soon to tell?
Well, the polling does suggest that the Democrat is certainly capable of winning this. It's a Republican-leaning district, but not so much so that a Republican winning is a foregone conclusion. The interesting thing about this race, though, is that the Republican, he voted to fund Medicaid expansion when Governor Kasich slammed that issue down the legislature's throat. So he caved on that issue. There was a very pro-Trump, pro-conservative candidate running in that primary, but she lost by 700, 800 votes only because some establishment super PACs came in and just whacked her with negative ads. So that resulted with this milquetoast pro-Medicaid expansion Republican getting the nomination. So the conventional wisdom is that these establishment candidates are the only ones who can win a general election. Well, nowadays, if you cannot bring out your Trump base to come and vote, those establishment Republicans are not getting the job done in these general elections. So I think the Republicans have only themselves to blame if this candidate loses in this seat.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
U.S. Senator Kamala Harris thinks federal taxpayers should subsidize housing in California. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine take a look at her proposal. Eric?
Let's say that you live in Omaha, Nebraska, or maybe Erie, Pennsylvania, or Raleigh, North Carolina, or wherever it is that you happen to live. How would you like to pay for the housing costs of people who make $100,000 a year but claim that they're poor because they live in the San Francisco Bay Area? That's what Senator Kamala Harris and a few other Democrats from expensive blue states want to do, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you are listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christian Britschke. He is a colleague of mine and associate editor at Reason Magazine and Reason.com, and he joins us now to talk about this story. Christian, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
One of your latest pieces takes a look at this proposal from California Senator Kamala Harris. Tell us a little bit about what she wants to do, allegedly, to address her state's housing problems.
So what this bill would do is it would give renters earning up to either $100,000 across the country and in some high-cost areas $125,000. If you pay more than 30% of your income in rent, this bill would give you a refundable tax credit. Refundable meaning that even if you don't have any tax liability or obligations, you would still get money from the federal treasury. And there would be a sliding scale, so if you were earning $25,000 or less, then this bill would pay for 100% of your rent over and above 30% of your income, and then that slides down to 25% once you start making $100,000 a year, but still a significant transfer of taxpayer dollars from homeowners and people who don't live in high-cost areas or who have cheaper rent to those who have more expensive rent.
Yeah, transfer. I think that's the good word for it. A lot of progressive policies ultimately boil down to redistributing wealth one way or another. It's usually up and down the income scale. And regardless of how you might feel about some of those ideas, this one really jumps out to me because it's not so much about rich versus poor. It's some of that, of course. But this is redistribution based on geography. I mean, if you live somewhere more affordable, well, sorry, you've now got to pay for someone who might earn more money than you do, but that other person happens to live in San Francisco or New York. And I don't care how expensive the housing is in those places, if you're making six figures in California, you know, you're doing okay. You're doing just fine. You certainly don't need a handout from the federal government, which is to say, you don't need a handout from other taxpayers.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the argument, I guess, is that rent is expensive in these places, and therefore we need to do something to help out renters. But you're right. It is pretty much a transfer from places in the country where housing is cheaper and maybe homeownership is more prevalent, which would honestly be a lot of states that don't end up voting Democrat, to areas that are a lot more blue, these really expensive coastal cities. And there is kind of a fairness issue there, right? Asking kind of one group of people to subsidize another. And then on top of that, you know, no one forces you to live in high-cost San Francisco as well. These folks can move to cheaper areas if they want. They're not stuck in these areas. So I think there's a real fairness concern there.
Yeah, and it's not just Kamala Harris pushing this. We should point out it's also Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut, Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire, and the other California Democrat in the Senate, Dianne Feinstein. They are all backing this proposal as well. So it's basically a collection of senators from more expensive states who appear to be saying, hey, red staters, we don't care if you earn less than our residents do. You still have to help pay for their housing. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. We are talking with Christian Britschke, He's an associate editor at Reason.com. Christian, we could joke about the silly politics at play here probably all day, at least for the next few minutes. But we should also talk a little bit about the underlying issues that are driving this proposal because, hey, housing is really expensive in California. Harris is right about that part.
Yeah, most certainly. Housing is incredibly expensive in California. It's incredibly expensive in Connecticut, which is, Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut sponsoring this bill as well. But the issue there is not that the government doesn't give people enough or renters enough tax credits. It's that the government makes it so hard to actually build housing. California has some of the highest development fees for new development in the country. It has its cities have some of the most restrictive zoning regulations, which limit what you can build where, when. It also has a extensive permitting process in most of the cities, which allow every activist group and their mother to object to a new development and drag out the process. All these things end up coming back on renters in the forms of higher rent. And what Kamala Harris's bill would do is, I mean, these are local problems. There's not much federal policymakers can do to fix that. But what Kamala Harris's bill would do is instead ask countries that have not had such restrictive land use regimes and therefore been able to keep their housing costs low, ask them to subsidize California's bad behavior.
Yeah, it allows California to continue with that bad behavior and maybe even do more of it because you're going to be subsidizing these costs. You're going to be hiding the costs. And that usually means that that prices will rise. And as you said, Christian, this is really a local issue. It's a supply issue. At least when I look at it, I don't really see what the federal government can do here.
That's right. Unless you you open up supply, you're not going to bring the price of housing down. And in fact, you could very well see the price of housing or rent go up in California as a result of this bill, because all it would do is boost demand and make consumers less price conscious, particularly if the federal government is going to be taking care of 75% of your rent over and above 30% of your income. That's going to encourage you as a renter to look for higher cost apartments, and it also means landlords can jack up rents on the prospective tenants. And so this bill would just fuel demand while leaving supply stagnant, which is a recipe for increased prices.
No, that's a great point. We are unfortunately out of time, but that's a really great point to leave off on right there. That is Christian Britschke from Reason.com. Christian, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And again, Christian Britschke is an associate editor for Reason Magazine. You can check out his latest work at Reason.com, including his story on this Kamala Harris proposal. The headline is New Kamala Harris Bill Asks Federal Taxpayers to Subsidize California's Housing Costs. Check out his work on straw bans as well while you're there. Seriously, the straw issue. We got to have you back on to talk about that, Christian, because this is just blown up all across the country. But we've got to go for today. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us, folks, and catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Not only are Trump administration officials harassed at restaurants, but a former Trump official is drawing fire from other professors at a university where he has been hired to teach. Colin Hanna of Lead Freedom Ring USA has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Remember the expression from former House Speaker Tip O'Neill, "All politics is local"? As true as that may have been when he coined the phrase, it has now effectively been replaced by a new truism. All politics is personal. All politics should really operate on a plane that is always above the personal. But in the age of social media, 24-hour cable news, and a decline in the ideals of responsible journalism, that's simply no longer the case. Politics is more viciously personal than ever in my lifetime, and the shortcut to assuring media coverage is increasingly to make the most ferocious personal attacks virtually without regard to their credibility. There is a current case in point in academia that illustrates these points clearly while exposing the intellectual dishonesty among the proponents of tolerance. The person in question is Mark Short, who recently left the president's White House staff as Director of Legislative Affairs. I have known Mark for over 20 years, going back to when he and his wife Kristen were the caretakers in residence of Ronald Reagan's wonderful Rancho del Cielo in the mountains above Santa Barbara. After a few years in that paradise, but separated from the day-to-day turmoil and excitement of Washington, Mark decided to return to nearby Virginia while getting his MBA from the University of Virginia. After getting his degree, he joined the staff of the Department of Homeland Security and then the staff of Kay Bailey Hutchison, the moderate Republican senator from Texas, eventually rising to her chief of staff. While there, he hired a colleague of mine for several years at Let Freedom Ring, Matt Makowiak, to be the senator's press secretary. Here's some of what Matt said to me this week about Mark. Mark was an incredible boss. He became a mentor to me, helping me grow, offering both encouragement and constructive feedback, and increasing my responsibility over time. He was an outstanding manager, giving senior staff room to maneuver while also remaining in charge of the team and leading the organization in the direction the senator wanted. Mark then went on to become chief of staff to then-Congressman Mike Pence of Indiana when he was in leadership as House Republican Conference Chair. Through his time on Capitol Hill, Mark gained a rare understanding of how legislation moves and how the place really works. He developed deep relationships with members across the aisle and senior staffers in many offices and on many important committees. In many ways, these two jobs prepared him to run the Legislative Affairs Office for President Trump. Mark Short is a principled conservative. For well over a year, he performed one of the toughest jobs in this White House, and he earned plaudits from everyone he worked with. The passage of the first major tax reform bill in 31 years is a testament to his drive, his focus, and his skill. It is disgraceful to see certain professors and students who do not personally know Mark Short protest his one-year fellowship at the Miller Center at UVA, where he earned his MBA. Mark is an outstanding individual, a strong Christian, and a devoted husband and father. He is a wonderful friend, and he will be a great addition to the faculty of UVA. Yet the contempt and hatred for Donald Trump in academia is so intense that it rejects this good, gentle, thoughtful, insightful, and analytical public servant merely because he worked for President Trump for a year and a half. Mind you, he is perfectly suited to the fellowship he was extended at UVA because it's in an ostensibly nonpartisan affiliate of the university whose area of study is presidential history. So where are the high ministers of tolerance, the preachers of academic freedom? Their tolerance does not extend to anyone who has worked with President Trump and challenged media and academic bias. Two professors resigned from the Miller Center simply because Mark Short was granted a fellowship and then wrote an obsequiously self-serving op-ed about their decision in the Washington Post, a newspaper that has led the decline of responsible journalism in covering this president. The professors say that Trump has departed sharply from recent precedents by, quote, breaking the norms of presidential behavior, upending the rules of civil discourse, and casting doubt on the meaning of truth, unquote. That justifies rejecting anyone with firsthand knowledge of the Trump presidency in their august study center on presidential history. It also justifies their resignation from the center. Their first conclusion is an egregious departure from the very nature of academic inquiry and analysis. Their second conclusion, that they should resign, is a good one. Good in the sense of good riddance. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota, KTIA-FM in Des Moines, Iowa, along with WRNN-FM in Warren, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.